team approaches to patient care, changes in nurse hiring practices, a look at California nurse anesthetists and oversight, and we're going to dig into depression. If that's what you're looking for, you found it. It's The Nursing Show. Well, good day and welcome to this week's episode of The Nursing Show. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and I'd like to take an opportunity to invite all of our new listeners, because we have quite a few of them, according to some of the things I've been seeing on the site, that we would love to have you come over and check out nursingshow.com. You know, we've been seeing a lot of you picking up the show, I think, via iTunes and other places like that. Come on over to nursingshow.com, check out the links and show notes information associated with each and every episode. And while you're there, sign up for the Nursing Show newsletter. Of course, for all you long-term listeners, there's no excuse not to be visiting the Nursing Show site for updates and articles, show notes for every episode, and good ways for you to comment back on each episode and articles you'll find over there. You can comment on each and every article. There's a link at the top of each article that you can click to leave a comment. You can also just send in those comments to our new email address, nursingshow@gmail.com is that nursing show address. And of course, you can always just catch up with me via Facebook, Twitter, or any of the social media sites like that. I'm usually found under the handle PodMedic, so you can check in with me there. And I love to catch up with all of you whenever you check in with me. Even though I'll be traveling quite a bit over the next few weeks, I always return emails. So if you're going to be sending me those emails, get them in, and I will get back to you within at least a few days or so. But I try to respond back to any questions or comments you might have. And we've got a lot of great interview segments that are coming up with nurses in various nursing careers to kind of just share out some additional information of all the various ways nurses interact with patients on a day-to-day basis in their jobs. So look forward to that in the coming weeks. Let's jump on into this week's news, and I'm going to lead off with a story that looks at a recent study examining team approaches to patient care in the hospital. Now, I'm sure many of us are familiar with various types of team approaches to patient care, and this particular article is from the Archives of Internal Medicine. This is from the Journal of the American Medical Association. I don't usually like to refer to those types of articles, but there's some things in this study that I wanted to point out, because this focuses exclusively on the multidisciplinary approach among physicians, that you might have a hospitalist working with a surgeon, working with an infectious disease specialist. And they talk a little bit in this article about other members of the care team, including nurses and other healthcare professionals like pharmacists. But I'm interested in the fact that while they talk about how important it is for communication between the different physicians involved in patient care, I don't see anything in there that talks about who really provides the glue that keeps that team organized and in touch. And that, I think, is the nurses on each of these floors that are in charge of these patients. These nurses that have to handle patient care and coordinate between multiple physicians, looking at multiple sets of orders. And really, it is the nurse's job who provides direct patient care for that patient to really make sure that the docs are talking to each other and make sure that the orders don't conflict with each other. And I was interested by the fact that this particular article talked a lot about how important it was to coordinate rounds, to involve pharmacists in the planning of medication and pharmacological therapies, but it doesn't talk in there about the importance of involving patient nurses directly in the patient care process. I think this is just typical for what you'd expect to find from the Journal of American Medical Association, but we all know how we provide that direct care, and we provide the key link that puts all of these things together. Without the nurses interpreting the care orders for that patient and making sure and providing some oversight to make sure those orders are correct, it is not going to provide the optimal care for our patients. And so I just wanted to point out this article. It's something that may be coming up in discussions as you guys approach team care changes in your facilities. A lot of physicians, I think, will be referring to this article, looking at how important it is. I think it's also vitally important that the nurses involved in any revisions in team approaches make sure that nursing care is included as part of that process, because we provide all of the direct patient care. We provide all of the discharge planning, and these patients aren't going to get better without the nurses to do the work. Maybe I'm preaching to the choir. In fact, I know I'm preaching to the choir, but I wanted to make you aware. You should check out this article. There's a link in the show notes, and give me any feedback you might have after reading it on what your thoughts are about what it says about team approaches and communication. Moving right along, another article on nursing jobs and changes in hiring practices. You know, I think we can all remember just not that long ago when hospitals were paying bonuses to get nurses to sign, were giving away packages like vacations or additional benefit packages. And we've largely seen a lot of that go away in a lot of areas, simply because nurses have returned to the workplace. Experienced nurses that were working part-time or working more hours, nurses that had left the workplace to go home and be with family or to move to another career path have come back to nursing, and nurses that were expected to retire just haven't. This is an effect of the recession, and this particular article I looked at calls this a change from nursing being recession-proof, that it's no longer a recession-proof job, and I actually disagree with that. Just because hospitals aren't having to compete as much for nursing jobs, I know that there are still nursing jobs open in my area, and I've seen a lot of openings for nursing jobs in many, many places. Now, that may not be true for every single location out there, but I do know that there is still a shortage of nurses to some extent, and I think that it's just not so extreme that hospitals have had to start offering some kind of major incentives like they did in the last 5 years, 5 years ago before the recession hit, and that type of incentive program was actively being used to get nurses into the workforce. Speaking of nursing workforce issues, there are some things going on with some of the healthcare reform debates, looking at the fact that more nurse practitioners and primary care nursing as a way of providing patient care directly for those patients that don't have a primary care physician. And some of the things are coming to heads as the American Medical Association and other doctors' groups in certain parts of the country, in the case of this article, California, are looking for ways to increase the physician oversight of advanced practice nurses, especially nurse anesthetists, and that this is something that is coming up in an upcoming vote in California. This is something that doctors are calling an issue for patient safety, and every state sets some of those boundaries for nurse practitioners themselves, and it looks like there's a push for California to provide more oversight. And of course, my feeling is, I have a feeling this is more about the fact that more anesthetists can bring on nurse anesthetists into their practices. There is not going to be direct oversight by an anesthesiologist. They're still going to be requiring that nurse anesthetist, that advanced care nurse, to be in charge of anesthetizing and intubating and managing patient care during a surgical procedure. The anesthesiologist will be picking and choosing from perhaps difficult cases or different cases that fit into their care plan, but they will be providing oversight, which means they can, of course, bill for those nurse anesthetist services. So I think this is what the debate is really about. It's as always in a lot of these healthcare issues, it comes down to money and who gets to bill for what. And we'll be interested to see how this shakes out, because if primary care nursing becomes a bigger issue, there's going to be a pushback from a lot of physicians who are going to want to have oversight over any nurse involved in direct primary care of patients. Time for this week's tip and trick of the week. This week's tip of the week for the nursing show is going to be a look at depression disorders and what we need to keep in mind as nurses when dealing with patients with depression. You know, I think every care plan for nurses, every aspect of patient care that we have should look at depression as a possible something that might crop up for our patients at all levels. And this is just because, you know, it's just part of life. Sometimes major events occur and our patients will be depressed. Will it progress to a major depression and require other treatment? Maybe not. But certainly early recognition could help hold off the severity of a depressive episode for our patients if we recognize that that is indeed where they're headed. So good communication practices are key. Let's look at this as we go down through looking at depression. We're going to talk a little bit about where depression comes from, some thoughts and theories about that, how we differentiate depression from just normal life event sadness, also assessing depression and treating depression, and then nursing considerations as always, because hey, this is the nursing show. So what about the etiology, the theories behind how depression occurs in a patient? Well, there are a lot of different ways that we think depression might occur. I looked around and found four real big theories on how it occurs. Biological theory, I think this is pretty straightforward. It's a genetic predisposition to depression. That genetic portion of our cognitive selves, our behaviors and our personalities may be predisposed to depression. And we might see that and be able to assess for that in a family history for a patient. There's also a theory that there's a cognitive basis, that some patients, because of how they've been raised or the decision-making processes that they've developed over the course of their lives, have developed a just negative processing of things. And so when a major event comes along, if you're always doom and gloom and always a glass half-empty kind of person, it can be very difficult for you to see a positive in a negative event. And this could make you more predisposed towards depression. Another version, life experiences, the psychodynamic theory behind depression, I think is our Freudian theory, if you will. This is saying that some early event in our lives caused us to be predisposed towards depression later on in life. And so there could be some truth to this. Is I think it's some combination of all four of these in patients. I think there's certainly evidence that there is a family history factor, and certainly that some patients can think themselves into depression, and some patients might have had an experience in their life that caused them to be depressed. This goes on to the fourth thing, learned helplessness. This is related to a post-traumatic event. Somebody had some major trauma happen to themselves or another person, their lives or someone else's life was in immediate danger. They have the normal anxiety response. We talked about anxiety disorders in past episode recently. And they, because of how that event occurred and transpired and the results of that event, they feel helpless. They felt helpless in being able to influence the outcome of an event, and therefore their whole lives have become helpless and everything is hopeless and helpless. So this is just a possible side effect. And so you should find out if any major events have happened in someone's life. What about a major or minor depression? You know, the normal everyday aspects of our lives that we deal with, minor depression following any major life event, the death of a spouse or a child or a close loved one, losing a job. These are things that happen that cause us to be depressed, but is it a major depression? Can we bring ourselves out of it, or do we need assistance? So the major distinguishing factor is that minor depressions are short periods of depression. They don't fit all the criteria of major depression in the DSM-4, and they are people are able to move forward out of the depression on their own. And so That's one of the ways we can differentiate. How long have they been depressed? A major depression is something that's going to impact their general functioning. They're not going to be able to, they're not going to get up for work. They're going to start staying at home. They don't want to leave the house. They don't take care of their ADLs. And when you see this, patients who are not able to function socially or occupationally, that's a sign of a major depression. And when you couple that with a group of these other things that are associated in the diagnosis, anhedonia. Anhedonia is the inability to have fun, even when other people are having fun in the same event. This would be, everyone else around you is laughing because of something funny that happened. You're not laughing. You aren't even really paying a whole lot of attention to it, and it just isn't funny to you. It's not that you aren't having fun. It's that you can't have fun. Altered sleep patterns, weight changes, either weight loss or weight gain. For me, it's alien to have weight loss associated with depression, but hey, you know, I guess for some people that works. Or not doesn't work, as the case may be, but you should be aware of that. Recent weight changes, activity levels increasing or decreasing. Generally, patients can become agitated when they're depressed, and or they can just become completely without energy. Anergia, the lack of physical activity and doing the things that need to get done. Feelings of worthlessness, thoughts of death, suicidal ideation, making a plan to hurt or injure or kill oneself. These are all signs of major depression. And if someone has had a prior episode of major depression, this is predictive of future episodes and you should be aware of that. Again, we talked about the different things that you might want to look for, but when we're assessing a depressed patient, the number one thing you need to look for is yourself. You need to look out for your own safety. Provide an exit for yourself to get out of the room. Make sure that the patient is not between you and that exit when you set up an interview. You need to set up a way for yourself to protect yourself in case, for some reason, this patient decides that the best way to harm themselves is to harm you first. And this, you know, we're dealing with behavioral patients. The thinking is not always logical. We need to ask them, as always, as nurses, open-ended questions, and we need to just engage in conversation with them, but important questions we need to ask. Have they had persistent thoughts about death and dying and hurting themselves? Have they thought about dying or killing themselves? And have they put a plan together? Have they thought about how they would do it? Have them explain it to you. I know that seems maybe counterproductive, but actually talking about it, bringing it out into the open may be a big step towards helping them. So don't be afraid to ask these questions in the process of assessing a patient if you think that they've become seriously depressed. Also, just sometimes spending time with them, you know, being in the same room, you know, offering, if you're coming over to provide care and you just say, hey, I'm going to sit here for a little bit. I have some paperwork. Do you mind if I sit here and do it nearby? And being present can sometimes make a big difference. These patients are distancing themselves socially from people around them because they don't feel they have the worth to do that. So provide them the feeling that they have worth by being worth sitting next to. You should think about the different ways that we as nurses will be interacting during treatments of depression. Usually it's a combination of medication treatments and psychotherapy. For patients with extreme depression, refractory to some of the other treatments, they may be getting electroconvulsive therapy. But it's something to be aware of and prepare yourself for. Educate yourself about the different medications. Are there different types of antidepressants out there? The old-fashioned antidepressants, the tricyclic antidepressants that were very prone to dangerous overdoses and death from using these antidepressants. You know, clearly at the time it was all we had, but when you think about the fact that you gave a medication that could be easily overdosed and kill someone to someone who was in danger of being overdosing or killing themselves, we needed to find a better solution. So other medications have been developed, but a lot of patients, older patients that have been depressed for a long time and treating themselves and following a treatment program very well may still be on these because they work for them. And so you need to be aware that the tricyclic antidepressants like Elavil, Tofranil, and some others are out there. SSRI, selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, this is the Celexa, Paxil, Prozac, Zoloft, are the first-line treatments in many cases for medications for depression. Also, another class, the serotonin, norepinephrine reuptake inhibitors, a different class of these antidepressants, and this one includes a Cymbalta, Wellbutrin, and Effexor. They just have a different effect and may be used for patients perhaps with mild bipolar disorder to deal with depression. Also, for patients though that's not other things aren't working, MAOIs may be used. The monoamine oxidase inhibitors. These are used as second line treatments because they have a lot of dietary restrictions associated with avoiding the presence of tyramine in foods. And these patients need to be monitored carefully and educated carefully about dealing with dietary restrictions. So make sure that you're aware of that and provide the additional educational support patients on MAOIs may need. Nursing considerations, again, just protect your own safety first. You want to make sure that you're assessing patients when you suspect that they're depressed for suicidal thoughts or thinking about death and dying, and ask them if they've made a plan to carry out any of these thoughts. You need to ask those questions. It might be necessary to make a deal, and there's been some evidence that this is a positive way to deal with this, developing a contract for patient safety. You make a deal with them, they make a deal with you, and because they've now engaged with someone else and are beholden to someone else for following this contract, it may have some effect in lessening their risk for carrying out suicidal thoughts. I think it's not something that you don't know, but just letting you know again, restraints are really being frowned upon. Physical and chemical restraints are considered counterproductive, especially for depressed patients. And think about it in this regard. You're depressed. You don't think you have any worth. You think society would be better off without you. And see, here's the proof. They're tying me up. So think about that when you're thinking about considering restraints for a patient. Now, I'm not talking about short-term use of restraints who's actively violent and needs chemical or physical restraint to protect themselves and others, but we should be working towards getting those restraints off as quickly as possible and managing their treatment in other ways. Educate the family members. We want to get these patients back home as quickly as possible. And once they're stabilized, because they can begin functioning again and begin building up their self-worth again in that regard. But they need support from their family and understanding from their family about what depression is, how to recognize if they are needing additional treatment changes. All these things can be important. And then follow-up care. Follow-up. A patient may go a long time on treatment and then decide, you know what, I don't need to take this anymore. I don't like the side effects and I haven't had a problem with depression for years. Well, guess what? You know, the medication was working, was altering their brain chemistry and doing its job, and they have decided that that's not what they want to do. Now they're in a difficult situation. They're not medicated anymore and they may need to come back in for outpatient or inpatient treatment directly. So following up with patients regularly and monitoring them is going to be an important part of this. And you know what? Nurses are good at that kind of thing. We can do a good job with follow-up, telephone follow-ups, and care with the patient and their families to make sure that the treatment program is being followed and finding out if they want to change. Maybe the medication side effects have changed in severity. Well, there are a whole host of medications we just talked about. Certainly, we can maybe bring them in and see if there's something else that may be better option for them with either the nurse practitioner, doctor, whoever's engaged in their treatment. I would urge you to check out the show notes. There's links to some great resources, the National Institute of Mental Health, the American Psychiatric Association, and there's a great article I found there in the December 2006 journal MedSurg Nursing, and you can find that journal directly, or I found a link to an online version of that article as well. Check those links out for additional information and in-depth looks at treating depression and patients with depression. And that's going to wrap up another episode here of The Nursing Show. I want to remind all of you that you can find a lot of additional resources, articles, and other show notes for other episodes all over at nursingshow.com, along with all of the information, like you can sign up for the newsletter, how to get in touch with me, links and study tips for student nurses that are listening to the show, a lot of other great information, all available at nursingshow.com. And of course, right at the top of the page, you'll see a link for show notes. You can go there and see the most recent episode of The Nursing Show, and then scroll down to previous episodes if you want to check out a link from something you heard last week or the week before. You can find it right there. If you want to get back in touch with me with a comment or a correction, definitely get those corrections in. If I make a mistake, I need to correct it so we get the best information on the show. So send those in to me. You can send emails in to nursingshow@gmail.com. You can also contact me directly via the website. Leave a comment on any of the episodes there. I get an email when you do that, and I can respond back to you that way. And of course, you can always follow me under the handle PodMedic at Facebook and at Twitter, and contact me by messaging me there. So I urge you to check that out and follow up with me any way you need to. That's going to wrap up the show. I will close out with some PodSafe music. This is a song by Ingrid Michaelson, "The Way I Am." I've played it before on the show. It's one of my favorites, so I'm going to close out with that. In the meantime, I want to remind all of you, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. I'll be back again next Friday with another episode of The Nursing Show, so you can set your calendars and be prepared to listen to that when it gets posted on Friday. In the meantime, don't forget to remember to stay safe and stay tuned here to The Nursing Show. Take care.